ACE Fast Closure. This is an acronym that I used, still use sometimes just for a memory jog, but I used when I was first beginning to close wounds. ACEFAST, closure. What we want to do is take an overview of this and then dive into each item individually. A is for analgesia and hemostasis. You got to think about this. We'll talk about this in detail, but the lidocaine you choose, or the analgesic you choose that's injectable, it may have epinephrine in it. Epinephrine is a vasoconstrictor that will help with hemostasis. But there are rules in using this. We'll talk about that. Analgesia. C is for cleansing. You got to cleanse the wound. E is for examination. If the wound is severely contaminated, you cannot examine it thoroughly until after or during cleansing. F is for foreign body. Consider it. A is for antibiotics. Consider them. S is for surgical consult. Consider this. We're going to talk about this in detail. T is for tetanus. We're going to talk about the rules associated with tetanus and why it's such a big deal. And then closure, actually closing the wound. The ACE fast actually gets you there. The closure is what you do. Learning this and applying it every time, it's going to really cover your butt in a lot of situations. Analgesia. So your aim should be to anesthetize the patient's wound within 20 minutes of their arrival. I promise you, this will go a long way in patient satisfaction and pain control. You get some patients that come in, and I swear, you look at their cut, and you look at their history, and you've maybe pulled their CSMD, and you think just to yourself, did they just cut themselves to get pain control, to come in and get some kind of narcotic? It's horrible for me to even suggest. It's horrible for me to think, but this is the world we live in, especially in emergency and urgent care. So I have had patients that have literally done this. And you can tell the lacerations are very straight. They're always from an angle that you might see on a self-inflicted wound from a, you know, attempted suicide, but it's usually on the dorsal forearm. And they're really complaintive. And they're asking, at the moment you step in the door of their room or, you know, the exam area, they're asking for pain control. And the pain is disproportionate to the degree of injury. So anyway, enough on that. Lacerations are most painful over the exposed subcutaneous tissue. There's a lot of nerves in the subcutaneous tissue. There are a lot of nerves in the dermis and epidermis. So there's associated pain there as well. The goal with anesthesia is to focus on the dermis and epidermis. The best needle to use is a 25 gauge, 1 or 1.5 inch. The smaller diameter needle does cause less damage to the target tissues, and the longer needle makes it easier for you to see where you're sticking. So what medicines do you use? Here's a list. I'm going to include their concentration, their time for onset, and their duration of action. So lidocaine 1%, this is what we typically use. You can use it with or without, but we'll talk about the rules. And that's with or without epinephrine, which is a vasoconstrictor. So time to onset is 2 to 5 minutes. I always wait 5 minutes. Now you get some people that go in there and they stick their patient, you know, to anesthetize and achieve analgesia. And right then and there, they start working on the LAC. And, patient satisfaction and pain control are going to be decreased if you don't wait 5 minutes. My rule of thumb, you know, with that 20 minutes within 20 minutes of going in there and looking at the wound, you know, greeting the patient, assess the wound, and then get them anesthetized and achieve analgesia. After that 20 minutes, I don't go back for 15 or 20 more minutes. And I let this lidocaine or whatever I'm using really work. So the duration for lidocaine is 6 to 8 hours. That's a pretty good amount of time. That's the lidocaine 1%. Lidocaine 2% is essentially the same as far as duration goes, 6 to 8 hours, but time to onset is around 1 to 3 minutes. It's got a higher concentration, so you're going to have less of a time for onset. Why would you use one versus the other? Availability. Or you've got a patient, and this is true with epinephrine, because epinephrine has a synergistic compatibility with lidocaine, and that it makes it last a little longer, and that it makes it last, or work rather, a little better. So you get a patient that has history, whether they tell you or you start to work on them and they say, ouch, but then they tell you that they have a history of poor response to analgesics and, you know, the injectable kind or epidural or whatever they say. And so you might go to a 2% or even a 1% width. And that's going to create a synergy there. And really, it does make a difference. You get these patients that after you know you've numbed them up, they are numb as can be, you think. And they're saying ouch the whole time. And it's a literal ouch. You can tell they're in pain every time you stick. Go with a lidocaine 1% width or lidocaine 2% plain or with epinephrine. That combination is a little harder to find. So then there's Marcaine. Marcaine 0.5%, bupivacaine 0.5%. So the onset is about 30 minutes. You stick these people and you need to wait. You have to wait. But the duration is around 12 hours, which is really great. You can really do a lot of good with this. You just have to wait. These are typically used, well, we'll talk about that. So it's important to note that if you have lidocaine with epinephrine, you should always avoid using it on the ears, nose, fingers, toes, and penis. I've sewn up my fair share of penis injuries, and don't think that's just an outlier. You'll encounter this in your career. So ears, nose, fingers, toes, penis. Don't use epinephrine. There are studies out there that support small use, small dosages, small injections. The fear is that the vasoconstriction will be to such a degree that we actually cause tissue necrosis. We don't want to do that. That's bad. So epinephrine is a vasoconstrictor. It helps to control bleeding. If you've got a scalp wound or any kind of profusely bleeding laceration or wound in any other area aside from ears, nose, fingers, toes, and penis, use it. It really works great. And I don't use anything else on scalps except for 1% width. For most lacerations, you're going to use 3 to 10 cc's of lidocaine. That's all that's needed. The proper way to numb the skin is this. So you got your forceps or glove fingers. You're gently holding the lacerated skin in place. You've looked at it. You've cleaned it. You know, this is an analgesia. We're going through the ACE fast closure. But cleansing in this order, you're going to do a deep cleansing later. Cleansing in this respect just means you've brushed away the debris. You can clearly see the demarcation lines of, you know, where we have poorly approximated tissue, where the cut itself is. And it's into this field, this area that you're injecting your analgesic. So you insert the tip of the needle into the dermal layer of the laceration itself. I have seen physicians, I have seen providers do a field block around, you know, a relatively small, you know, less than 6 centimeter laceration. And it really doesn't achieve the same anesthetic effect. You don't achieve as good of an analgesic effect if you do a field block where you inject around the laceration. You need to inject into it. You want to inject until the section that you're currently on swells to 2 to 3 times its normal size. You want to do this every 1 to 2 centimeters, and then you want to wait. You want to wait for that onset of action. It's a good idea to test to make sure the area is numb. You're going to ask the patient to close their eyes, and using the tip of your needle, you're going to prod the skin and ask them to tell you if they feel anything. Deep sensation is normal and will not go away with this type of anesthesia. The objective is to eliminate sharp sensation. The advantage of using Marcaine or bupivacaine over lidocaine, this is what we talked about earlier, in the medication list, is that it lasts so much longer and is used for digital blocks. Cleansing. Irrigation with sterile water should come first and should be performed with moderate pressure behind the sterile water. Significant irrigation will thoroughly dilute bacterial concentrations and will help remove debris without scrubbing. Cleansing is next. My default is chlorhexidine gluconate, aka Hibiclense or Dynahex. This is normally on hand in every facility. Cleansing a wound requires that the wound first be anesthetized, It also requires some scrubbing, poking, and digging, with a mind toward the question, what could be hiding in here? Regarding betadine, a very reliable and oft-on-hand cleanser, studies do suggest that it can actually lead to poor healing and may even cause tissue damage if used in a 100% concentration on the wound bed. If you're using betadine, dilute it with 50% sterile water. The betadine solution is also an excellent choice for soaking finger, hand, toe, and foot wounds. Every foot, toe, hand, and finger injury I treat, I pre-soak for 20 minutes in this solution. This is the 50% betadine, 50% sterile water. I have yet to see a patient return for infection issues. Here's a medico-legal nugget. Chart the length, width, and depth of the laceration. Chart the solution you use and the method you use, scrub, soak, etc., to cleanse the laceration or wound. Examination. You've got to look at the wound. What is its shape? Is there curvature? Is it straight? Is it multifaceted? Is the wound near a joint or large artery? Know the location. Know the anatomical landmarks and structures that could be involved in the laceration. You've got to touch the wound. Simple, simple, simple. But you can't examine and diagnose from the door. You must touch the wound. Assess how deep the wound goes, its length, width, is it gaping, and its shape. Document all of this. Assess how much it is bleeding. If bleeding is controlled, document that the wound is hemostatic. Now examine the patient. Have the patient move the affected part, whatever it is, through active range of motion against your passive resistance. Compare the strength on both sides of the patient's body and document your findings. For normal findings, you might document NVSI, neurovascular status intact, proximal and distal to injury. If there are deficits, document them and then consult a surgeon. Touch around the wound with your gloved finger and assess for lost or diminished sensation. Document your findings in both normal and aberrant cases. And formulate a plan for closure. Will this be a single layer or multi-layer closure? I had a patient one time who had a wrist laceration from some glass. It was the volar aspect, distal wrist. He complained that he felt sort of tingly in his thumb. This was the radial side. He had some mild tendinal involvement. I was concerned. I called an orthopedist. He was actually there at the hospital. He came by and saw the patient. And we both determined that the patient had severed his radial nerve. So we talked through this, what the surgeon might do, what the patient might experience. And the conclusion was, we're really not going to do anything. A small degree of reduced sensation was the only sequela to this injury. The surgeon did advise that he could repair the nerve damage or attempt to repair the nerve damage in the coming weeks, but he did advise that the surgeries were 50-50 in terms of success rates. You have to touch your patient. You have to look at their wound. You have to touch the wound and probe it. You have to assess it, see how deep it goes, look at its shape. You have to know the wound. When you get to doing this over and over and over again, you can do it in a minute or two, but you must do it. You can't do it from the door. The plan that you formulate for closure is going to come from your assessment, your examination, and your gestalt, your gut feeling. What do you think needs to happen for this wound to be repaired? It will grow, that gut feeling will. Foreign body. Retained foreign bodies can be painful for the patient, can contribute to infection, and can come back to bite you in the butt medico-legally if you don't consider them, look for them, and at least attempt a removal. Always consider a foreign body's presence until proven otherwise in the case of lacerations caused by breaking glass, especially in the case of a motor vehicle crash or a window. Always consider that debris, such as wood, leaves, grass, other materials, are foreign bodies. Every effort must be made to completely irrigate and cleanse the wound of debris. A great way to visualize glass and a laceration is through plain film imaging. Glass is hyperlucent on plain films and will usually show up, but you may need to tweak the contrast and magnification. Always order a three-view series if you're ruling out a foreign body, because three views will give you three different planes of vision into the wound. Document your findings. If it was a concern for you, it will be a concern for the patient's lawyer if there was a foreign body and you did not document the attempt to find and remove it. Here's a medico-legal nugget. I always verbalize to my patients with lacerations that I'm doing my very best to minimize scarring, clean the wound, search for and remove associated foreign bodies when applicable, and make the process as pain-free as possible. I chart this. And I also chart that they verbalized understanding of my advice. Consider foreign bodies when appropriate. Antibiotics. Antibiotics are not indicated for simple lacerations. However, there are some types of wounds and some patient populations that are more prone to infection. Grossly contaminated wounds and wounds involving massive tissue damage should be treated with a course of antibiotics. Animal bites, including dog, human, or otherwise, should always be treated with a course of antibiotics. Diabetics should always get some type of indicated antibiotic for foot or hand lacerations. This includes punctures. Lacerations that involve a joint should get a surgical consult, and you should ask the surgeon what anti-infective they recommend. Chart all of their recommendations, including the antibiotic. If they, for some reason or another, do not recommend an antibiotic, at least give your patient an IM cephalosporin or an oral course of antibiotics. Open fractures, which are lacerations that involve a broken bone beneath the wound, should always receive a course of antibiotics. For oral lacerations, unless it was so bad that you sought a surgical consult, antibiotics are usually not indicated. Surgical consult. Always consult if you can see a moving ligament with obvious signs of damage, or if the affected part is weaker than its contralateral counterpart. To determine this, have the patient move the affected part through active range of motion against your passive resistance. Compare the strength on both sides of the patient's body. If there is a deficit, consult a surgeon. Most of the time, orthopedic surgeons are not going to repair a tendinal injury unless it has sustained a laceration through greater than 50% of its diameter. Always consult if there are neurovascular changes. Neurologic changes include changes in sensation. Vascular changes include changes in skin temperature and color, and arterial involvement. If the patient, bystanders, nursing staff, or you have witnessed spurting blood, the injury involves an artery until proven otherwise by a vascular surgeon. If the mechanism of injury was a crush or direct blow, get plain film images to rule out a fracture or dislocation. If you find either, consult an orthopedic surgeon and treat as an open fracture. Always consult a surgeon in the case of compartment syndrome. Compartment syndrome is excessive swelling of the region where the wound was sustained such that neurovascular status is compromised. Sensation and arterial flow become compromised because of the swelling. Normal treatment for compartment syndrome is a fasciotomy. Here's a medico-legal nugget. Always document your performance of two-point sensory examination and comparison of strength bilaterally, including your findings. If you get a consult, document date and time, who, what you discussed with them, and what their recommendations were. Tetanus. Tetanus is a big deal because it can kill. Tetanus-prone wounds include all wounds other than clean, minor wounds. Patients who have received the full tetanus immunization schedule and who present with clean, minor wounds do not need a tetanus booster. This is class 1. Class 1 is clean, minor wound, fully immunized, no booster. Class 2, patients who have not received the full tetanus immunization schedule. They haven't received the full schedule. Or in cases where this is uncertain, and they received their last dose greater than 5 years ago, and they have a clean minor wound. They only need a tetanus booster. Okay, this is class 2. Clean minor wound, just the same as class 1. We're not sure about their immunization status, and probably the last time they got something was more than 5 years ago. They need a tetanus booster. Again, this is clean minor wound. Class 3 is a little different. Patients who have not received the full tetanus immunization schedule, or in cases where this is uncertain, who received their last dose greater than 5 years ago, and who present with anything except a clean minor wound, need both a tetanus booster and a dose of tetanus immunoglobulin, that's the TIG. Adults and children age 7 and above should receive 250 units of TIG IM once. Children through age 6 should receive 4 units per kilogram of TIG IM once up to the 250 units. The bottom line rule, this is the rule you take with you every time you see a patient with a laceration. If the last vaccination dose was greater than 5 years ago, they should get a booster. Medical legal nugget here. Always chart their tetanus immunization status and any intervention you implemented.